This Week in Retronauts, many too many have stood where I stand. Everyone, welcome to Retronauts. It's another episode. I'm not sure where this one's going to fall in the numbers, so who cares? We're just going to talk about some stuff, and you're going to listen to it whenever we serve it to you. It's too late now. You're already in. You're here. You're listening. So, see, it all worked out. I'm Jeremy Parrish, being weirdly aggressive here in this panel, or this episode, being recorded in a hotel room in Milwaukee. That's probably why I'm being aggressive. Anyway, I'm not alone here, here witnessing my podcast wrath. We have
Nadia Oxford of Retronauts and Axe of the Blood God, and something about Milwaukee just makes you aggressive, so I understand.
I think there's just like a fine mist of beer in the air.
There kind of is.
Everywhere you go, it's like you go to Vegas and they're always misting you with water to keep you cool. Here it's, they're always misting you with beer to keep you a little drunk. I think that's how it works.
I think so.
Kevin, would you care to expound on this theory? As you introduce yourself.
I'm original Midwesterner Kevin Bunch. I run the YouTube series Atari Archive and occasional Retronauts guest.
And there's another person who's going to be sharing your microphone because TSA stole one of mine, which was very cool.
Yeah, if you want to come over here to closer the mic.
Hello. I didn't know we were going to do it this way, but
I actually thought you were going to hand it off, but if you want to do the Zaphod Beeblebrox thing and just have two heads, one body, that works too.
We can try doing that. I'm up for being head number two. I'm Brian Clark from 1millionpower.com, translator guy.
All right. So we'll try to get you guys to jump on separate segments so we're not doing the shouty thing. Because no one likes that, except, you know, people in Milwaukee
who are all aggressive.
And TSA.
Because of the beer mist.
And the TSA.
TSA doesn't actually like it when you yell, believe it or not. They get a little upset.
They also don't like it when you transport eggs across planes.
Oh, yeah.
I did that, too.
The good news is you weren't going across international boundaries, because that would have landed you in jail.
That would have.
You'd be going to egg jail.
Yeah, I don't think my Canadian coworkers are going to be thrilled.
Eggland's
with that.
Worst. All right, so this episode, we're talking about mini consoles. And this was going to be an episode about mini consoles and computers, but then Stuart Jip, who is the only one who cares about mini computers, he couldn't make it. So we're just going to talk about consoles, and he can have his own episode talking about the Amiga A500 Mini or whatever it's called. We don't have to. And the C64 Mini and whatever else there is.
The ZX Next or whatever it's called.
Oh, yeah. I have one of those on order. I've supported like two of those, and I still haven't gotten one. It's great. They just don't want me to have a Spectrum, so I'm going to keep talking trash about it. It's not my fault. It's the official Spectrum people's.
Curse of Clive Sinclair.
That's right. So this episode, yeah, we're talking about the rash of the spate of mini consoles that has descended upon our lands. I say lands because Nadia's here from Canada.
Yes, on the extra land today.
Yes.
All tucked away down there.
All tucked away down there like America's hat should be.
But, yeah, I mean, kind of these things kind of became popular and started to become a really big business after Nintendo said, hey, we should sell back nostalgia to people in the form of a tiny Christmas ornament-sized console. And everyone said, yes, I want that under my tree and on it. And it became a big thing. And now everyone's in on the action. Some of them are doing a great job. Some of them are not. We're going to talk about them, and we are going to name names.
Oh, we are.
Because some of the bad ones need to be called out.
Absolutely.
But I would like to ask you what your personal history with dedicated mini consoles is.
I guess start with me. First of all, of course, I had, like, back in the aughts, everyone had those plug-and-plays for, like, you'd have, like, three Genesis games on there, and, like, you'd buy it for a friend, you'd take it to their house, and the emulation was usually terrible, but it was kind of fun. But I guess I started with with most people, the NES Classic. And that was actually funny because it came out at a time when, I'm sure you recall, it just sold out immediately and the stocks were not there and people were frothing at the mouth for this stupid thing. And that was also the year that I got surgery. And I swear to God, I'm lying on the table, and the anesthesiologist is behind me saying, "Hey, do you know about games, right?" Because we're talking about my job. And he's like, "Can you get me an NES Classic?" I was like, "Well, not really now, because I've got like an IV in my vein, and I'm like high as hell." But no, you're not going to have any luck whatsoever. I'm really sorry to tell you that right now.
You should have been more positive. You were about to go under the knife. That person held your life in their hands.
Now that you say it that way, you got a point.
You do not have a good survival instinct.
I'll give you 10, please.
Like, I'll hook you up for sure. Let me call Reggie.
Let's see how the surgery goes, and we'll see if I can get you one.
But, if you hit me up with the more morphine, more morphine means more NES. But I also have the SNES Classic, which, of course, is excellent. We have the TurboGrafx. I got that for my husband for Christmas one year. And I think that's all I really have for mini consoles. I was going to get the PlayStation, but I'm sure as we'll get into, it wasn't worth it in the end.
You're spoiling everything.
I'm sorry. Kevin. I can't help it. I'm mad about PlayStations.
Kevin, what about you?
So I remember when the very first plug-and-play plays were coming out, my grandmother gave me one that was just full of Activision games. And it was basically just like shaped like a controller. The emulation was terrible, but it was a neat little novelty. And then like I played a few of these... few other ones like the at games flashback units. I played a little bit of those.
Yeah.
But you know, like Nadia, it wasn't until the NES Classic came along that I was came back around and decided to see what was going on with the world of mini consoles. And it turns out, you know, some people were actually doing it pretty well.
Mine were actually relatively more recent. Like I definitely fooled around with the NES and the SNES and the, you know, the Famicom and Super Famicom versions when they came out, because various people I knew had them. But the first ones I actually bought for myself were the arcade focus ones. So like the Astro City Mini and the Egret 2 Mini more recently.
Yeah, and as for me, this is kind of my job. My career, my whatever I do, my existence. So I've been tracking all of them and accumulating all of them. And some of them I regret more than others. Mm. Some of them I'm very proud of. But others I'm like, why did I even take this out of the box?
It looks nicer in the box. I should have kept it there.
Yeah, looking at that,
because the boxes usually are like very accurate recreations of the original boxes.
They're nice.
Yeah, I've never actually opened the PlayStation one because I bought it and then tried it. And said, "Wow, no, bad, terrible. Why did this happen?" But fortunately, the standard, you know, the quality bar for these is generally higher than what Sony put out. I don't understand. Well, I kind of do, but I want to say I don't understand. How could it be so bad? Back in time, once upon a time, all consoles were dedicated. They just had Pong on them, or like four versions of Pong. Here's Pong with a line in the middle, here's Pong without, here's Pong with extra paddles, here's Pong with extra balls. It's just, you know,
And here's Pong, we're just calling it hockey.
Right, exactly. Like, please understand, this is supposed to be on ice. So that was just kind of the way of things for a long time. And then the idea of interchangeable cartridges came along. And so then really you only saw dedicated handheld devices like the Game & Watch and then the Tiger Electronics LCD handhelds. And then, you know, in the late 90s, you started to get the little keychain-sized Tetris. And
yeah.
Tamagotchi came along, which I guess isn't really a video game, but it kind of is. I don't know. It's weird.
It's a waste of time is what it is. But a video game that's a waste of time. I mean, a lot are a waste of time, but it was especially a waste of time.
There you go. We finally defined what a video game is.
Yes. It's if your time is wasted.
Mostly a waste of time.
That's right. So by that point, we come to the 21st century. And all of a sudden, there starts to be an uptick in the idea of, like, people going back to the idea of creating inexpensive devices dedicated to playing a single game. Which, Kevin, you mentioned the dedicated units. I think Nadia did, too.
Yeah, the Genesis.
The ones I remember were from Jax Pacific, J-A-K-K-S. And a few of these I covered in the press. Like they would come around and bring us demos, and I was always very unenthusiastic about these because even then, like, I wasn't, you know, by any means super discerning about emulation quality, but I could still tell that they were kind of not that great. They only had like composite video out. It was like, okay, you can play Ms. Pac-Man and, you know, Mappy, but is this really the way to do it?
With a 5-second lag, didn't really do you any favors when you're talking about like really intense games.
Right. Weird sound.
The muffled, yeah. There was a lot of problems with the audio and a lot of those things.
Yeah, and I remember one of those junkets, they came around and were like, yes, we've really improved the quality of these things. But at that point, I kind of feel like it was too little too late.
Yeah.
Also, you saw a lot of dedicated consoles start to come out in the like the first decade of the century, the millennium, really, that weren't accurate recreations of the original games. So you mentioned Intellivision. I think Intellivision and Atari both had these flashback units, which were they were NES systems on a chip.
Yeah, the original Atari Flashback was an NES on a chip, and I think Jack's Pacific put out an Intellivision, like one of their controllers with a bunch of games on it, that was also an NES on a chip. So someone had to reprogram all of those games for NES hardware.
And these are very interesting to people like Frank Cifaldi, who tried to document all these weird instances of, you know, like trying to say, what is every official game ever released that can run on NES hardware? And it's kind of hard because a lot of these devices they manufactured were not high quality. They would put glob tops on them, so you can't really easily, you know, break down the chip and get access to the information that's on it. But it does seem like there are a lot of games, like Frogger, which never came out on NES, has been made on NES by Konami for these dedicated handheld systems. Mm-hmm. So there is like this whole interesting history there. And, you know, around the time that these were coming out, you also started to see Famiclones, NES clone hardware, at like mall kiosks and just, you know, sketchy little shops in Chinatown or wherever, where it's just like, hey, here is a thing that looks like a plastic gun, but actually it's a Nintendo system. Or, you know, here's an N64 controller where only two of the buttons work because actually there are NES games inside and you only need A and B. So like there's a you know, a hard plastic non-interactive joystick in the middle of it and you just use the D-pad. And, you know, none of those games were licensed and eventually Nintendo cracked down on them and everyone went to jail.
Oh, I actually didn't know that part. I know, because you're right, I remember seeing them everywhere at one point, and then they just vanished. And it was always like, oh, there's like 1,000 games on this, and it's, you know, 50 versions of Super Mario Brothers or whatever.
Yeah, but some of these are like the NES on a chip of Jack's Pacific ones. Because the NES patents on the hardware design ran out in 2003, they were able to sell these free and clear as long as these games were licensed or made from the ground up. So,
right. The problem wasn't that they were NES clones.
Yeah, it was the
The problem was that they had like 5 different versions of Contra with different color schemes. And you can't do that. So Nintendo cracked down like... was it like 2008 or so?
That sounds about right.
It was a few years after the NES patents expired.
Right, right.
And these things really proliferated for a while, and then all of a sudden they just dried up, and that's because Nintendo went after... I don't think they really went after the sellers. Like, they probably went after a few sellers to make examples of them, but I think they really went after the distributors.
Yeah.
The distributors and the importers to kind of cut it off at the source. So all these little NES on a chips full of pirated cartridges coming in from Taiwan or whatever dried up. And at that point, the mini console market was pretty much just, you know, Atari and Intellivision, who, like, their games are pretty free and clear. Like, there's still kind of a direct ownership to those things. Like, I think Blue Sky Rangers holds most of Intellivision. Is that right?
They did at the time, yes.
They did at the time, okay. And Atari was releasing whatever Atari was at the time. They were releasing Atari first-party games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there wasn't a legal issue. And these were okay. I don't know. What were your thoughts on the
So the second Atari Flashback is actually pretty interesting because it's like a 2600 on a chip. And that was designed by the late Kurt Vendel of Atari Museum. And you could actually mod that thing to run original Atari cartridges if you really wanted to.
Nice, but useless but fun.
It had composite out if you wanted a really roundabout way to play those in composite, I guess. But all the ones since then were emulation, and the emulation quality sort of, it's all over the place depending on the model. But they'd load these things up with basically all of the first-party Atari games that didn't require an extra license like Pac-Man or Space Invaders, and then they'd license out cheap stuff from Activision and M-Network stuff that the Blue Sky Rangers had the license to, a couple things from like Parker Brothers or Konami. And, yeah, I mean, for the market they were going for, which was, you know, it's a cheap Christmas gift for family members.
For boomers. Yeah. Nostalgic boomers.
Nostalgic boomers, Gen Xers, it fits.
Yeah.
The Intellivision one came out, geez, what was it, like 8 or 9 years ago at this point?
It's been a while.
Yeah, that and the ColecoVision one. And I can't speak to the ColecoVision one. I heard it's not great, but the Intellivision one, I guess, is pretty good. And you could, if you still had your old Intellivision overlays, you could even pop them in.
You're set.
You can even get adapters to use the new controllers they made for this on your old hardware.
I'm just thinking of the those things you're talking about, the screens that you put over. Like, how small would those be on HDTV? Just you're kind of pathetic.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't really play Odyssey 2 and you know, games with overlays on modern televisions.
No,
I'm gonna put my Vectrex overlay on my HDTV when I load up Vectrex on
Mr. Just scotch tape it on there, you're fine.
Yeah, it'll look perfect, right? Yeah. but the build quality's all over the place on these things. They eventually got a lot of rights to do a Sega one, and the At Games Genesis units are a bit of a meme, I think.
Yeah, I now that you said it, in the back of my mind, I realized there was a thing with that. It was pretty bad, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't really share it publicly, but I reviewed one of those for US Gamer and posted some footage on my YouTube channel of Sonic the Hedgehog. And it's just like, it's astounding how out of pitch it is. It's like off key. It's
a miracle how bad it is.
Yeah, like I think you actually have to try to make Genesis music sound that bad. I mean, Genesis music has a dodgy reputation because of all the people using Jims as a sound driver, which was pretty hit or miss. But this is just like I think that reputation is unwarranted and unfair. But you know, the way people act, like, this is what Sega Genesis actually sounded like. I need to dig that up and have that edited in here so people can hear, like...
It's like, yeah, the Genesis was infamously hard to make good music for, and Sonic, the Sonic games are probably the best example of great music on the Genesis, and just to have it turn into that horrible cow music or whatever it was just sound like a herd of cows dying. It's really a shame.
Yeah, so the At Games Genesis debuted around a decade ago, and I think these did a lot of damage to a lot of reputations. Like, I think they made people assume, you know, standalone dedicated mini consoles were a bad idea. Like, these were really the first, among the first devices along with the Atari and the Intellivision to say, hey, let's recreate the form factor of these consoles. And, you know, they tended to be closer to the actual original size. But the Genesis one in particular really sold on recognition. Like, it was games that were much more recognizable to a modern audience than a lot of the stuff on Atari or in television. A more contemporary game experience. You would have stuff like Mortal Kombat on there.
Yeah.
And all of it was just shockingly bad. It would be like 80 games on a device, and about 16 of them would be recognizable licensed games, and then a whole lot of stuff that was just like freeware made by like some random Taiwanese studio.
Yeah.
And it would just have the weirdest names, like P-Cow or something. I don't even know.
And Sudoku would be in there for some reason.
Sudoku's always in there.
I think this is before Sudoku, actually.
One of the Genesis At games has Sudoku.
Oh, man.
I looked it up, and I'm like, wow. Genesis Sudoku.
Sudoku on a controller. I can't think of anything more thrilling.
Yeah. That's what you need the menacer for, obviously. Just shoot the letters.
Yeah.
Oh, I shot the wrong number.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, so that was by a company called Ad Games, and they're still around somehow. They have they weren't run out of business or run out of town on a rail. And apparently their work has improved a lot with the tabletop devices that they've got, like the Ad Game arcades.
Yeah,
which have like 600 games on them. I don't know how that's economical, but supposedly that emulation quality is greatly improved, but I just can't trust that company.
Yeah, they really damaged, as you said, the whole idea of a mini console in addition to their name. Like, it was, well, we were just listening to the video of that Sonic music. Anytime you forget how bad it got, you just got to go back and listen to that, put it in your nightmares.
Yeah, anytime I ever think about checking out one of their more recent flashback units, like the Atari one, I'm like, I don't know, though. It's at games. It's not going to be worth it.
And these were devices being made in, like, 2013, 2014 that only had composite out. They didn't have HDMI. They didn't have S-video. It was just composite. Mm. Plug that into your HD TV. Get it stretched out, get like 3 seconds of lag in there. That's some great experiences.
Yeah, I don't think they added HDMI to their flashback stuff until after the NES Classic came out. I think it was
around the same time. It might have been the year before, but it was really, really belatedly.
Yeah.
And, you know, at that point you started having non-representative consoles come out from like Retrobit that did offer HDMI and much higher quality emulation. So I think that kind of held At Games' feet over the fire. And I know, like, I talked to Sega PR and representatives when they were working on the Sega Genesis Mini, and they were like, yeah, we're aware of these. And, you know, the company, the division of the company that licenses them out, I don't think they get it, but we know that we have to exceed that. We can't, like, we have to undo all the damage that has been done to the Sega Genesis brand by these terrible other mini consoles. So, you know, that was an uphill battle for them to face. I think Nintendo being much more rigid about licensing and a lot more aggressive about shutting down unlicensed product, they probably had less of an uphill battle to fight because there weren't really, you know, dedicated mini NESs around or, you know,
yeah.
It's like the NES on a chip had more or less become a thing of the past. Like, I think they still are made to some degree, but it tends to be for like really weird kind of one-off type things.
Yeah, I think the Jack specific or whatever those style of things, I think they still use NES on a chip technology. I'm sure Frank Cifaldi will jump in in some Twitter thread to let us know.
I think we can, I feel like the first attempt to really make a good mini console was the Neo Geo, wasn't it?
Is that the Neo Geo Mini or the Neo Geo X? Because they're two different things.
Oh, no, the Neo Geo X was not good. I had
no, it wasn't. But I think that was Neo Geo's or SNK's first attempt, and
that's true.
They disavowed it after, what, 6 months?
I've never even heard of it, so there you go.
It was a smaller version of the Neo Geo, which, you know, that's not hard to do. That, I don't know what was inside of it. I think it was emulation.
It was just an emulator, yeah.
But they, instead of just, like, having a bunch of games baked into it, they actually sold collections of games on SD cards, basically.
No thanks.
But they were official SD cards that came in, you know, Neo Geo game clamshells.
That's kind of cool.
And then you would plug them in and you had, you know, access to some pretty cool stuff, like, it was a good lineup, good selection. You know,
the emulation was fine, like it wasn't awful, but it wasn't great.
Right, and they, you know, they offered like the Neo Geo style controller, and I think a gamepad. So it was, you know, like $150 for a full setup, and it was okay.
It wasn't worth the money.
And actually, no, I remember. Sorry, I just remembered. It was actually a mini handheld device.
Oh, that's right.
It was like
you
can
pop it out
case. Kind of like an oversized Game Boy Micro. And then you could plug it into the Neo, like open up the Neo Geo plastic shell and put it into the fake console and have it run to your TV that way. So, like, as a handheld device, you know, kind of in the game park style, it was fine. It was kind of cool that, you know, it was basically a portable Neo Geo emulator that you could take with you. Like, it's neat that it existed. And it was cool that they kind of did the Switch thing long before Switch, before
yeah.
any of that became, like, the future of video games or whatever. But yeah, like, it was okay-ish. But when did the Neo Geo Mini come out?
I feel like the Neo Geo Mini, I looked this up yesterday, I want to say it was around 2018.
Oh, so it was after the NES. For some reason in my head, it actually came before, but you're probably right.
I think it was the Neo Geo X that we're just conflating okay, the dates yeah. with.
Okay, so in that case, then yes. It is the classic NES edition that really set things off.
Yeah.
That was 2017, and I've talked a lot, so I'm going to let someone else talk and explain why this was cool and interesting and everyone went nuts over it.
The NES Mini, the first and most endearing thing about it is it looked like a little tiny NES, and you even pushed the power button to get the whole thing on, and I think you hit reset to get the menu.
Yep.
Yeah.
It had a little spring-loaded reset button, just like yeah. the NES.
And it had a couple of Acura controllers with terribly short cords, as I recall. And the selection of games, now personally, I wasn't huge on the entire selection of games. There's a lot of black box stuff there. And, I mean, we can debate forever about how, like, the quality of those games and whether, like, you know, they're worth playing today. Like, didn't it have Ice Climbers? I can't remember.
It does have Ice Climbers. Exactly. It's like 10, okay, so there were 30 games on it.
Yeah.
10 of them, I think, about 10 were black box, and the rest were later. And a lot of third-party stuff. Weird omissions, but, you know, some classics for sure.
Oh, definitely some classics. It's certainly one of the better miniature consoles.
To its credit, they did not put Urban Champion on it.
Oh, there you go. Fail,
that's
fail,
always
fail.
The litmus test.
But thinking about it, of course, being an RPG nerd, just thinking about how we'll get into the SNES Classic, but that had so many excellent RPGs on it, and then I'm going back to the NES Mini and saying, hey, where's Dragon Quest? They put Final Fantasy on there.
How many really great NES RPGs were there, though?
Dragon Quest 1, 2, 3, and 4.
I don't think all of those hold up. Like, who really wants to play Dragon Quest 2 in this game?
Okay, Dragon Quest 2
fine,
doesn't
but
hold
three
up.
3 still hold up. 3 is still
I
excellent.
I can see 3 or 4. I can see them
I can
putting
see
that
three
on
or
there.
4.
But I also can see Square Enix being like, nope, Dragon Quest's our baby. You don't get to put it on anything because that devalues it. It never showed up on Virtual Console.
That's true. That's yep. true. I forgot about that. Yep.
They could have put Earthbound on there. They didn't.
That's right, Earthbound Zero or Beginning yeah. Zero, they called it.
Which is okay because Earthbound is not very good. The NES game?
The NES game
the
is
NES
kinda
game?
Crap.
Nah.
It's fine. It's just very 1990.
It's yeah. full of great ideas.
Which is to say it's not great.
It came into its own on the SNES, so yeah, I'm not surprised they didn't include that. But they did include the original Final Fantasy, and that to me was always an interesting inclusion. Like, I knew Final Fantasy sold better than Dragon Quest in the West, but I didn't really realize it was really enough of a nostalgia thing for people to latch onto on a miniature NES.
You know, Nintendo pushed that game really hard.
That's
they
true.
Published both that and Dragon Quest first party in the US, just the original Dragon Quest. And Final Fantasy got a huge push.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, Nintendo Power was kind of their main line of communication. It was the Nintendo Direct of its day. And it had millions of subscribers at that point, and there was a very brief period where initially it was bi-monthly, and then for a while it was bi-monthly, and then on, like, off months, they would put out these strategy guides for players.
Ah, right.
So the guides they put out, there was a four-player guide, there was Ninja Gaiden 2, there was one other one.
Mario 3.
What's that?
Mario 3.
Yes.
That's the one I had.
Yes. Oh, hey. And then there was Final Fantasy. There was a big contest they ran. They did a promotion. It was like the summer of Final Fantasy. You know, they gave away 4 Palantirs, basically.
Oh, dang.
it was a big deal. And the game did, I think it did really well. And it was kept in circulation for a long time. I remember going to Toys R Us in like 1999. And there were copies of Final Fantasy complete in box for $20. And it wasn't because they were, you know, remaindered. It was because they just kept publishing that game.
Right.
I think they probably republished it after Final Fantasy VII hit big. Mm. There were like one final sense. Push. That,
yeah.
I would not be surprised if that was the case. But
so I guess I definitely see then, like, from a nostalgia angle, why Final Fantasy would be a game where, say, a Gen Xer turns on the system and says, oh, hey, I remember that. I'm going to play that. Oh, God, this is terrible. But Yeah, we'll get into the SNES Classic, like I said, but I feel like that selection was like practically all hits, whereas the SNES Classic, it was a system where I was like, yeah, playing some of these, but not all of these. Of course, Super Mario games are all just fantastic, and yeah, that was the NES Classic.
So, I mean, a big thing about the NES Classic, besides the fact that, like you mentioned, it was a perfect little reproduction of the NES, the controllers that it used the same controller interface as the Wii remote plug-in.
That's right, yes.
So they kind of repurposed some technology. They probably had a ton of those connectors just sitting around.
Hanging out.
So I'm sure they were like, let's, you know, make use of these and get them out, because Wii is gone at this point.
So, that might explain why they didn't produce these things for all that long.
That could be. Good point.
Yeah, it might have just been like doing a lot of things at once, including using old components that were, you know, just going to...
Got to recycle them. Yeah, you're right.
Be wasted. So, you know, it had games built into it. It had a menu interface, very simple and direct, a very clean interface. Like, you could scroll through the games, and then you could have save states.
That's right.
And save high scores and that sort of thing. I think you could have 4 save states per game, 3, 4.
Yeah, that sounds right. And you had like a visual filters you could put on to make it look like a composite thing or whatever.
Right. And, you know, it did HD out through HDMI. It could only do 720p, but that's fine because that's, you know, an even integer of the NES's resolution.
Exactly.
So everything looked clean and the emulation was produced by Nintendo European Research and Development, or NERD, which is a great acronym.
Yeah.
It was the first many of us had ever heard of NERD, but they did a very good job with it, and it turned out that the NES Classic ran on basically Raspberry Pi technology, and people very quickly realized you can hack this thing, and you can put more games on it. It's not just 30 games, it's 600. It wouldn't support some of the high-end mappers like MMC5, so you can't do Castlevania 3, you can't do, you know, Romance of the Three Kingdoms or whatever, but just about everything else runs on there. I think it's up to, like, MMC3, and it has Star Tropics, so it can do MMC6 also.
Oh, yeah, so these things are very handy emulation boxes, that's for sure.
Yeah, so it's basically everything except the esoteric Japanese stuff that ran on third-party custom developer or mappers and then MMC5. So a very, very broad spectrum, and you could fit, I think, like 600 or 700 games on the system. It had a lot of memory built into it.
There were a lot of people complaining about how there weren't really that many games for how much memory that thing had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, people figured that out on their own, and even though that was not a selling point, according to Nintendo, it was a selling point. Like, it became
absolutely
a really easy to hack, all-in-one emulation box that you could have just sitting in a tiny spot under your TV and have access to all these NES games.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was the perfect product for, you know, the time and the season, and really the controller port thing is the only thing I can think of why they wouldn't.
I hadn't even thought of that, so that's a good point. I remember looking at that saying, oh, that's a weird choice they made, but as you said, they probably had a warehouse with them somewhere and said, we gotta get rid of these things.
Or, you know, it's just Nintendo being completely
weird,
baffling with all of their choices.
They do like the proprietary technology. They learned a lot from Apple.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Nintendo's way has always been to like take products that are just going to sit around and do something else with them. Like, say, you know, radar scope units or extra screens. Let's stick them in Punch-Out in the PlayChoice 10 and make 2-screen games. So, you know, that's just kind of Nintendo's way. But the NES Classic was interesting because it was very customized to each region. Not only the appearance, but also the software. Like, it has a very different lineup in Japan than it does here in the States. Like, all the games that came out here were like, oh, yeah, I know those. Whereas the games that came out in Japan, you're like, unless you really do a lot of importing, they might be pretty unfamiliar to you.
Did it have Zevias?
It did not, surprisingly.
Oh my gosh.
But it had a sumo game.
It did.
Really?
Pari Ozumo.
That sounds fun. Was it good?
I couldn't figure it out. It made no sense. It seemed like...
It also had Atlantis no Nazo. So, you know, it's games that people would recognize in each territory. But I feel like this is a case where America got the better side of things just because of the hardware itself. Because we got removable controllers. But in Japan, you know, the idea here was to make it very accurate to the original. And so the Famicom in Japan had hardwired controllers. And they retained that for the Mini. And they also retained the proportions and scale because the Famicom's controllers could dock in the sides of the hardware. So they kept that, which is very cute and neat. But they resulted in these tiny chiclet-sized controllers that are just too small to be practical. I was very tempted to get a Famicom Mini, and then the Shonen Jump 50th anniversary Famicom Mini, which is the same thing as the Famicom Mini, but it's gold instead of white plastic, and it's filled with terrible games based on Shonen Jump properties like Dragon Ball and I don't know what else. Brian, do you want to take a mic and talk about this?
Dragon Power.
Oh no, they didn't have sandwiches. They had panties.
Yeah, so it did have, I believe, all of the major Famicom Dragon Ball games, which it started out as Dragon Power, which was Dragon Ball Shenlong no Nazo, and then they kind of turned into weird like card battle RPGs for the next few. It had those. It had the Fist of the North Star, Hokuto no Ken games on it, which are all, like, boy, if you think the Dragon Ball games are bad.
Really? How do you screw up Fist of the North Star? You just punch people.
Well, one way is you make it into an RPG. That's one way you screw it up. One way is you make it so esoteric that you can't actually figure out what to do or where to go.
Or you just, like, have weird hitboxes. Like, Fist of the North Star came over here as Fist of the North Star. From Taxan.
Which was actually Fist of the North Star 2.
Right.
But yes.
But I mean, it's got like, you know, it really captures the look of Tetsuya Harada's artwork.
It does.
But it works really weirdly and you like punch over things. It's just awkward.
Everyone's too short in this post-apocalyptic land.
And in some of them, you have to actually know like what moves Kenshiro used to beat that opponent in like the original manga, and you have to use those same moves in order to win that
fight,
which is bonkers. It had like I don't have as much experience with these, but it had like Saint Seiya games. It had those couple of Captain Tsubasa games, which were kind of interesting, like RPGs things with really good music. Mm-hmm. It had Kinnikuman Muscle, which are also pretty rough. And then it had like the Famicom Jump games, which were like the kind of collaborations where they threw like all these characters that you kind of had to go through and find to like build your party,
like kind of like Konami Wai Wai World,
exactly, except with Kenshiro and Goku and all these
that
people,
actually that sounds like an amazing crossover. But too bad it didn't work out.
Yeah, those were the ones that most people would know. I mean, there were other anime properties that are less familiar. But circling back to something that was talked about earlier, that version also had Dragon Quest I on it.
Oh!
Which they did not put it on the original Famicom Mini, but they sure did put it in that because of its tie-ins with Yuji Horii and Shonen Jump and Toriyama and all that stuff. So,
I mean, Shonen Jump is a big part of why that series became popular in the first place.
Yeah, was it average? Advertised or
it was
something?
It wasn't advertised so much as just promoted,
right?
Yeah.
Because it had such ties to Toriyama and to Horii.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yep. And the system came in a box that was like a big like phone book size like volume of Shonen Jump that come out weekly on like Japanese newsstand.
It was a really cool bit of packaging and just for a terrible product, like
perfect for the shelf.
It's
then
horrible little controllers to play horrible little games.
That's so, the back of the box quote right there.
That's right.
Horrible little children.
So that was kind of the downside to the NES Classic Edition. But yeah, I think it did a lot to kind of remind people, hey, these are really cool games, and get people excited about them again. So, you know, in that sense, it's great.
Yeah, oh no, absolutely. Like, even though it wasn't my favorite of the consoles, like, its impact can certainly not be denied.
So the following year, I believe, Nintendo... Actually, I was trying to do this, just wing it on dates, and now I'm like, oh, time no longer has any meaning to me, and I can't remember the exact chronology of these things. Nintendo followed up with the classic Super NES edition, also developed by Nerd, and basically using the same technology inside. More limited in terms of how you can hack it, just because the Super NES was so reliant on special subprocessors,
yeah.
And a lot of those don't have support. So, like, if you want to play, I don't think you can do an FX game. Well, no, actually, it has Yoshi's Island. Yeah,
it has Star Fox. Yeah.
I don't know. There's some things you just can't do. Like,
I think Mega Man X3.
Forget Mega Man X3.
Yeah.
Is definitely, and forget those SATA. Shogi games that have the 33 megahertz coprocessor inside them sold for $200.
Holy crap, never heard of it. Those are amazing.
Yeah. I mean, they didn't come to the US, but in Japan, SETA published Shogi games with, you know, a subprocessor inside that was like 10 times as fast and powerful as the NES's
chip.
Dang. This was in like 1995, but basically it was like, here's an early version of what would be powering the Game Boy Advance.
Wow, that's
inside
amazing.
Inside the cartridge, just so it could do Shogi.
I was
going to
say, for Shogi of all
well,
things.
I mean, Shogi is a very, very complex game.
True.
Getting, you know, an AI that can calculate moves and, you know, use effective strategies.
Yeah.
That takes
some
doing.
That makes sense.
Yeah,
that just makes sense then.
But still, like, yeah, there's a whole thing about SATA just investing so much energy into their Shogi games. It's a really fascinating sidebar in NES history, Famicom history. Anyway, that's not there, so why are we even talking about it? No, there's much more overlap between the American and Japanese releases of these and European. Fewer games, though. I think it was just 20 games. Is that right?
21,
yes.
I think.
Oh, 21.
Because
they included Star Fox 2.
They did, and that made me realize, okay, now I understand why they canceled this game for Star Fox 64.
Even though it's better in every way except actually running.
No. I was playing... I'm like a real Star Fox purist, where 64 and the original are my jam, and just playing 2, I realized... This is where they started getting the idea for putting the stupid animals on the ground, and it just, it all went downhill from there.
But I do enjoy that they threw in Star Fox 2, because that was my reason for buying this.
I do appreciate it. Like, I think that was a great idea, a great piece of history to have, and they went to the trouble of making the artwork and the instruction booklet. That was great. I really liked that they did that. Just wanted a great game.
And there's a lot of other great games on here, too.
Oh, like, yes.
Like Earthbound is there, Contra 3.
Final Fantasy VI. Chrono Trigger was a notable missing RPG, but in terms of, like, the SNES had a very rich RPG history, and they really honored that. Would have liked to see Final Fantasy II now to think about it, but no, it was a...
I can understand why they didn't want to overdo
absolutely.
A single publisher or franchise.
Because they had a really nice mix on there. Like, they had some great action games, they had some, as I said, great RPGs, great puzzle games. Kirby, you can never go wrong with Kirby. I mean, with the Kirby, you have, like, games within games to begin with, so it's not just that 20. But yeah, it was less, but what was there was all very playable.
Yes. And yeah, it's a really broad range of genres, fighting games, RPGs, racing games, platformers, sports. Yeah, you've got some kind of dark horses like Super Soccer, which I did not expect, but it's there.
It's all right game.
Yeah. And, you know... There was the question of which Street Fighter do you put on there. They went with 2 Turbo Hyper Fighting, not Super Street Fighter 2, not Street Fighter 2 Alpha.
But they got Super Street Fighter 2 for the Japanese Super Famicom Mini.
Did they?
Yes,
okay, that's an interesting switch.
Because, you know, Hyper Fighting was big in the US, and in Japan, Super was the big thing after Champion Edition, so...
Because I always preferred Super, so I was also a little salty that we didn't get Super. Turbo's fine. I love Turbo, don't get me wrong, but... I love the new people, put it that way.
I think they should have put Street Fighter Alpha 2 on there, just because it's technically amazing that they made that even happen on Super
NES. I've never played that version.
You know,
it's compromised, but not as much as you would expect.
Mm-hmm. You can actually play it like you would play Street Fighter Alpha 2 on a different platform or the arcade machine. It just
doesn't look as fancy, but it plays well still.
I mean, they dropped a lot of frames of animation, but everyone's still responsive, and they have all their moves, and it's got just about all the characters. So it's remarkable. I mean, it ran on the same chip as Super Mario RPG, and it's a Super NES cartridge with load times, because everything is compressed.
Yeah.
And so there like has to run a decompression algorithm before every stage. So it's like a CD experience on a cartridge.
Just what you want. That's what Nintendo gave us cartridges for the N64 because there's no loading times. Well, guess what?
So anyway, yeah, that the Super NES Mini was pretty solid, but I was much more impressed by the Sega Genesis Mini
that
came out the following year, because they, like I said, Sega had a lot to prove with this, because, you know, Sega Genesis Mini consoles before this had really fluffed it, and they really needed to make up for the damage done by at games, and so they made up for it by putting out a real labor of love. Like, the Sega Genesis Mini, how many games does it have on it? Like, close to 50, right?
There's a ton. Like, there's a lot more than the SNES one.
It's
like
30 or 40?
It's more than 30. I think it's 40.
I think it might be 41 or 42, because they threw in, like, a new version of Darius that they made from the ground up, and I think a new version of Tetris from the ground up.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. Instead of having this done as an internal division, they gave it to M2. Like, Sega developed, I think, the hardware, but M2 developed the emulation and I think helped curate the software. And they did the thing that M2 always does, which is like, we're fanatical about this and we just kind of did our own thing. And so we're going to put that in here. And that'll be a recurring story here. But yeah, it's great, you know. You have the Genesis Mini and the Mega Drive Mini, which have much fewer. There's less sexual dimorphism in those two systems than in the NES and Famicom.
I like that you use that term. That's very clever. Thank you.
We've got to.
So yes, it's, you know, it's not like one has more colorful plumage. It's just like a slightly different version, but both of them, Sega produced style kits for. The American style kit was only handed out in limited numbers to media and influencers, so it's much harder to come by. But the Japanese one was sold at retail, and it lets you put your little miniature Sega Genesis or Mega Drive on top of a Model 1 Sega CD that doesn't actually work, but it's an accurate Sega Model 1 Sega CD. And you can also put a 32X on there. I think they also released a master system, a power-based converter.
Yes, they did do a power-based converter.
And on top of that, they manufactured like 30 different cartridges.
Yeah.
And I don't know how those were sold exactly, but I do remember going to Tokyo Game Show the final year I went, 2019, and dropping way too much money in gashapon machines. It was like, I think it was like 200 yen per crank, and I bought too many of those.
You're really
never too many.
Really trying to get that Slapfoid MD cartridge.
I didn't know that was one of them. I was just like, how many cool things can I get? And I got like Landstalker and Sonic 2 and Bare Knuckle. I was like, it's great stuff.
Yeah,
but it was just like this full, just so much love, just so much, you know, like catering to what they know fans are into. Just like, hey, here, have a game system. It's like, have a game system, dress it up, collect for it, you know, have fun with it.
Gashapon yourself to death. Was that the console that had kind of the bedroom set up as the menu, or am I thinking of a collection on one of the consoles?
Yeah, I don't think that was.
Yeah, that was the Mega Drive collection.
That's what I'm
Sonic
thinking of.
Collection or whatever.
Okay, yeah, because I just liked how that was so cozy. But no, the game selection, you're right, for the Genesis was extremely impressive. You mentioned Tetris. Am I remembering wrong that it was kind of hideous?
Yeah, the version of Tetris on there isn't great, but it's interesting because there's all this legal stuff around it.
Exactly.
I don't have my notes in front of me to explain what the whole story there was, but
If my memory serves,
it was like recalled or something, or
had a recall, and I don't remember if M2 could get permission to add that version of Tetris on.
Right, so they built a new one.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay, so
they built a new one in the style of Mega Drive Tetris, like the Forbidden Tetris,
because they're crazy people over there.
I love M2 so much. I mean, it wasn't a great. I mean, obviously they can make great games. It just wasn't a great game to begin with. So it was like, hey, you want to play shit Tetris? Here you go.
I just love that they, you know, because they're M2 and they're fanatics for, like, shooters and whatnot, they decided to fill this thing with, like, rare and expensive Genesis and Mega Drive games, especially shooters like Slap Fight MD or Musha. Those are both really expensive games, but they're on here. Or, God, what was the other one?
I mean, there was stuff like Mega Man the Wily Wars. That's not a shooter, yeah, but
right, that was
up until Retrobit's reissue of the game last year, that was really hard to come by because it was released in very limited quantities in Japan and never physically at retail in America.
And this was the Sega Channel version of it. Right. Like, that it was not available online, period.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a great collection of games. And, you know, it's M2, so the emulation is top-notch. The interface is very clean and simple. Yuzo Koshiro composed new music for the menu. Yep.
Yes, that's
so right. So it's not just, like, background musical wallpaper. It's like, oh, by the way, this menu is kicking your ears ass.
I'm pretty sure, unlike the Nintendo ones, you can still buy these. Like, they're still available.
They're still around, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, they didn't produce them in super limited quantities.
Yeah.
So, it's, yeah, highly recommended. I mean, it's a great tour through the highs and obscurities of the Genesis. I mean, there's a few games on here that I'm like, eh, who cares? But
yeah,
on the whole, it's mostly just, like, the really great stuff and the stuff that would cost you $1,000 if you wanted to own it. And that's a good, compelling mix. You know, you've only got one Phantasy Star game, but it's Phantasy Star 4.
It's 4.
That's the one you
really want to play now.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, they've got stuff like Comics Zone, which is more nostalgic than good. But, you know, then they've got... God, what else is in here? You know,
I mean, they've got the Mickey Mouse game, which is really good.
They've got a couple of Wonder Boy and Monster World games, including Monster World 4.
They've got Puzzle and Action Tant R, which I think was...
Was that on the U.S. version?
I think that's on the Japanese.
Okay.
I think the U.S. had Shinobi 3, which is another one that was a really late Genesis game that I don't know many people played.
The Japanese one is a puzzle game. What was it called?
It is a Puzzle and Action Tant R, which is a... You've got some experience with this one, don't you?
It's this on the Bonanza Brothers.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It has, the Bonanza Brothers characters. And
right.
It's like a bunch of mini-games.
Yeah, it's kind of WarioWare-ish. Before WarioWare, and the games are a little longer to compare.
Yeah, it's like their cheat to be able to say, well, we've got more games on here than the number that we have.
Yeah, right.
Tant R and Ichidant R, and it was a whole thing that it was, like, super obscure. The only place I've ever seen these games in the wild was at Mikado in Tokyo, because if you want to go see something obscure, you go to Mikado and play Darius 2 with all three screens, nowhere else.
Oh, wow. Neat.
Anyway, so all love to Genesis and Sega and M2. And then understanding that M2 is who you want to talk to, Konami hooked up with them to create the TurboGrafx Mini, which was, you know, a dual passion project, not just for M2, but also internally at Konami, because, you know, the TurboGrafx, the PC Engine, was originally produced by Hudson, and Konami absorbed Hudson, and there are still Hudson people active at Konami.
Wow.
And I interviewed the producer of this at Tokyo Game Show, again, the same, like, that final year, 2019. And he was, like, super jazzed about the whole thing. He had 3 different shirts that he would change into depending on who he was interviewing.
I love that.
So,
God bless.
You know, the TurboGrafx that America got was very different than the Japanese PC Engine. The PC Engine was like the size of 3 CD
cases. It's so cute.
Stacked up.
I love it.
It's so tiny. The TurboGrafx was like, you could land airplanes on it. It was huge and mostly empty space. And there was also like the Core graphics. So they produced basically one of these different designs for each region that they sold the Mini in. So in Japan, you got the PC Engine, the gray one. In America, you got the gigantic TurboGrafx-16. And here's the thing. It's called the Mini, but the PC Engine was so mini to begin with that they couldn't really make it that much smaller. So the TurboGrafx-16 Mini is kind of unreasonably large as a result, because they kept it in the scale. And then in Europe, they gave them the light gray core graphics.
Because Europe never got the original TurboGrafx. This was their first, hardware release.
So the producer, if he was interviewing, an American, he'd switch into his TurboGrafx-16 shirt. And if he was interviewing someone from Europe, he'd switch into his core graphics shirt. It was a lot of love. But as great as the Genesis Mini is, the selection of games on this one is mind-blowing.
It's magnificent.
They went to the mats. It's a collection of both Who cards and, CD-ROM games. And they just said, you know what? If we're putting this out in one territory, we're putting it out in all territories. We don't care if it's all Japanese text. I think the one game they didn't put on the American one was SD Snatcher.
I don't remember if it
was just that or Snatcher.
You're right. I think it was Snatcher, and I think they replaced it with Salamander, and I think that was the only change.
That sounds about right. But other than that, even Rondo of Blood.
That was,
it's just in there with the actual, German and Japanese dialogue and Japanese subtitles.
Man.
Just deal with it. It's Rondo of Blood. You're going to play it anyway.
You know as well as anyone, of course, just how unusual it is to me now, how accessible that game is.
So accessible.
<It's bizarre. laughs>
Who do we thank for that?
Right?
Yeah.
Konami, they finally cottoned to it.
Yeah.
Oh, are you saying you thank me because I paid money for it?
Yes, you paid the money for it.
And then they started reissuing it.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, what's Parrish up to? Oh, okay. Let's screw him.
But yeah, the TurboGrafx Mini was kind of delayed by the onset of COVID.
Right.
And, it was supposed to ship in 2019, which was before COVID. And
there was some shipping problems, I remember, because it was just impossible to get in Canada. And I forget the reason why, but my husband lamented for a long, long time. I think I blocked it out. But I'd got him one eventually. A really, really nice Blood God fan sold one to me. So that was really great.
But then it has an amazing array of presentation options.
Yes.
You can choose to do the Turbo Express style.
Yeah,
basically make the games just completely unusable. It looks horrible.
But you can do it.
But you can do it.
And it's got that weird kind of grid pixel shape. Not grid, but it's like a mesh or something. It's very unpleasant and kind of distorted. But God, they did it. The Madmen did it.
They have some real expensive gems on here too, like games that are great but also too expensive. Rondo of Blood is the Sapphire is for sure. Rondo of Blood's the floor for some of this stuff.
Sapphire was that was $800 or $900 a decade ago. I don't even know what it's selling.
It's absurd, however much it is. But Parasol Stars and Kadash, both games that were localized here by Working Designs and super expensive now. Blazing Lasers, Spriggan 1 and 2, a bunch of great compile shooters. Ease Book 1 and 2, they threw in some really good RPGs.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man, just looking at this list again, wow.
Oh, Tokumeki Memorial also wasn't on the American one.
Mm, that's right.
But they included it. God bless them.
Not only did they include it, but they also included, standalone, the little mini shooter that Konami put in Tokimemo on the PC Engine.
Nice.
If you use the video game system in someone's room, you get to play it.
That's great.
And you can just pick it in this.
So, yeah, that was the high water mark. I guess we should talk about the low water mark.
Womp.
The drained lake where it's all rotting fish at the bottom. And that is Sony's PlayStation Classic, which came out, I think, in 2018, 2019.
That sounds right. It came out before the pandemic, because my first experience with it was at a Library of Congress video game exhibit, where they had one playable in lieu of an actual PlayStation, and it was just sad.
I feel like, I know that COVID was probably the main reason it happened, but it felt like the whole mini console thing deflated after the PlayStation. And I remember they could not sell this thing. They could not move it. They could not give it away.
Well, no, the TurboGrafx came out after.
Okay.
Yeah, but that did, I think, pretty well.
I would hope so.
But I think, maybe the PlayStation caused the bottom to fall out.
Yeah.
And then the TurboGrafx set the bar so high, everyone was like, oh, we can't,
we're
we can't
done. Compete we're with done this. For now. Yeah.
But, like, the library on that thing seemed like it should have been okay. Like, okay.
When I was writing for US Gamer, I actually wrote an article. Like, we heard about the PlayStation coming. We said, wow. And I wrote an article. All the games should be on this thing. And, dear God, what a disappointment that turned out to be.
Like, you had Mr. Driller, I guess. That's
fine. That was okay.
You had Parasite Eve and Metal Gear Solid, Final Fantasy VII.
There was a Tekken on there.
There was.
Throw a Tekken on there, guys. Persona, the original. I guess because 5 was huge at the time.
And a lot of European PAL 50 hertz versions of these games.
Right. Yeah,
so that's the thing that really rankled a lot of people is that, okay, so if you're not familiar with the, like, standard definition display standards,
mm-hmm.
back in the day, America and Japan and Australia?
Australia was PAL, but there were a couple other countries
it was a pretty common standard. I think Middle East was NTSC. Never the same color, but 60 hertz refresh rates. PAL, which I don't even know what that stands for, it had a higher resolution, better color fidelity, but it only refreshed 50 times a second as opposed to 60, so it doesn't look quite as smooth and crisp to your eye.
Mm-hmm.
And if you, like, program the whole game that way, then whatever, you don't really notice a difference.
Right.
But if it's a conversion from another region, if it's done poorly...
A lot of times what would happen is, you know, Europe was kind of the unloved child.
The whipping boy, if you will.
Yeah, and so they would get games last, and sometimes they would be reprogrammed properly for PAL. And sometimes they wouldn't. So sometimes they would get a game that just ran too slowly. So the music was off tune. Like, you know that Sonic music we heard?
Yeah,
like that's the PAL experience right there. So they, you know, they took the short end of the stick. But when it came to the PlayStation Classic, Sony apparently said, we need to put the final builds of each of these games on the system, which makes sense. Like, the, you know, the final builds would have the fewest bugs.
Right.
And, you know, everything would be polished, fewest translation errors, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing is, most of those final builds were for PAL.
Right.
And they didn't bother to incorporate the 60 hertz options. So in the US and Japan, we got a bunch of PAL games. And, you know, Europeans, I think, were like, yeah, okay, PAL games, that's what we got. Whereas for us, who always had things so nice, we were like, I need to speak to the manager, please. Like, we kind of Karen'd out, and it's unavoidable because it really had a really negative impact on the gameplay.
No, absolutely. It was the game list that disappointed me the most, though, because, again, going back to RPGs, because of course I am, the PlayStation was a really, like, it was, like, shoulder to shoulder with the SNES and how important it was for the RPG genre in the West, like, bringing over all these games that were, like, inaccessible before. So it was an opportunity to, I'm not asking them to load it all up with RPGs, not even to the extent that the SNES did, but there was just so much missing, and some of their choices were very strange. Like, I love Wild Arms. I'll sit here and defend Wild Arms for hours, but even I know, okay, it's not exactly the most easiest game to play in this day and age, and certainly ugly as hell to look at because it had that mix of cute little sprites and horrible, jagged goblin triangles. So, I mentioned Persona. That was another strange addition because I guess because Persona 5 was huge at the time, they said, hey, kids, look at Persona, the original, and there's a reason why it wasn't really a big... It wasn't a big franchise.
They couldn't have put Eternal Punishment on there.
Yeah.
Yeah, Persona 2 was right there. And
yeah.
They decided to go for the first one.
Yeah, so it was... it just... When I read the final library, I said, you know what? I'm not even going to bother. And I did not.
And then they discounted them for like $15.
Did
and still
ever?
No one was buying them.
Yeah, it was just a big letdown. Like, the PlayStation was an amazing system. And Sony really struggles with their relationship with the past.
They really do.
I've read online that they've hired, like, or they've set up a division of game preservation. That sounds great. I'm very skeptical about it, but I'm you know, willing to see how it turns out. I would love for that to be a thing and for them to really turn around, like, say, mm-hmm. Sony's relationship with history. But, yeah, for the time being, like, this was just...
It's like they have a very, very powerful nostalgia behind them. Like, Nintendo knows what it has, and it capitalizes on that. Sony has always been kind of, you want some, want the Smash Brothers ripoff that we got? No? Okay.
I will say I respect the fact that they put Ridge Racer Type 4 on there instead of the original Ridge Racer, because it's by far a better game, even if the original Ridge Racer is the one that, you know, they like to go back to and say, like, oh, remember the nostalgia of seeing this for the first time?
Yeah.
But they actually said, no, let's put the one that has the kick-ass soundtrack and aesthetics and great tracks and the cars that you can decorate like Pac-Man. Actually, no, there is a Pac-Man car. And there's one that has like a Draga sticker.
There's also, I think this should be mentioned, is that I feel like PlayStation nostalgia might be a little harder to sell innately because PlayStation graphics did not age nearly as well as SNES graphics. So you could look back at Mario and say, oh, this reminds me of my childhood. This is, you know, this is really cool and makes me feel warm. And you look at again, some goblin made of three triangles, and you say, "This was cool when I was a kid, but maybe now not so much. It doesn't look as nice."
I don't know. I can't speak for the youths nowadays, but I do get the sense there is like a nostalgia for that for a certain age bracket that is not mine.
Oh, sure.
So
it's the same group that's sending GameCube prices through the roof.
Yeah.
Oh, so is that what they're doing now, the children?
Yeah, they're coming to kick our wallets in the gut.
So just do like you did in the 2000s and don't play GameCube games. It's much easier.
Well, Metroid Prime. I mean, everyone should play Metroid Prime.
Then Nintendo followed up all of this with the thing everyone really wanted, the Game Boy Mini. Oh, no, they didn't.
Oh,
no, but
right.
Sega saw what Nintendo didn't. They were like, we are going to do that. And they got really weird about it. As much as I love the Genesis Mini, the Game Gear Micro, I don't know. It's
a weird one. You know?
It is very strange. I bought all of them, but I didn't feel good about it. except the white one. The white one's really cool.
The white one is really good. That's the one I ended up with because they packaged it with the Aleste collection.
Now, as I recall correctly, weren't these things tiny? Like
they are so
they
tiny.
They are the size of a Game Boy Micro.
Right. That's bad.
That's bad.
Yeah, that's definitely bad.
If you are not like a 5-year-old, yes, it's difficult to play.
My 40-year-old eyes are not going to keep up with that.
The whole thing fits in the palm of my hand.
That is an odd choice. Like, why have this thing and make it unplayable? I don't understand.
Because it's a micro, it's a mini, you know, it's a little thing. So that's the appeal. I mean, this is different than the others. Like all the others we've talked about have really been about playing a collection of great old games.
Right.
Whereas this is much more about shelf candy. It's like, look, we've made five of these. And they're all in different colors, and you want to put them out on display, and they're so cute. Look at them. They're great. And they work that way.
Thinking about it, is there a whole lot of deep nostalgia for Game Gear games in particular?
Not a huge amount,
yeah.
No.
So it's not like people are going to want to play.
Game Gear is a platform that still hasn't really gotten expensive in the aftermarket, even though it's, you know, like 30 years old. Yeah, so It's just one of those things that didn't really catch on. There are some cool games on Game Gear, for sure.
And some of them are even on the Mini. Like, M2 did this, so M2...
Right.
The emulation is great, and
they're very good for what they are. But what they are is very strange.
Yeah.
So they're tiny. They run on a single AAA battery, or you can plug in a USB charger through USB micro. There's no built-in battery. I think they're too small for that. unlike the others, they do not have a video out option. They do not have a separate controller option. You can, however, buy the big window, the screen magnifier. They created a perfect replica of the original like Game Gear screen magnifier. You can put it on there, and it actually does make a big difference.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is remarkable.
You can't play it without that thing.
No, it's really tough.
Clearly not.
I'm super nearsighted in my good eye, and I'm still like... So like I said, there's originally five of these, one of which is an exclusive, but these were only sold in Japan because I think Sega was like, this is just not going to fly in America.
Yeah.
But each of the little mini Game Gears comes in a different color, based on the original colors that were released in Japan. Black, yellow, light blue, red, and then white. And each one is not just a different color, but has a completely different game lineup on it.
Right.
Yeah, they all have like four or five games.
Yes.
That's another interesting idea they went with. This is a very interesting system.
Yeah, it was.
Each of these sells for $50, so they're not cheap, and you get four games that you can barely play.
I have finished GG Aleste 1 on the Game Gear Micro, which was an experience.
But you did it. Like M2, you did it.
I did it. It's an interesting thing. Like, I believe it was done by Sega's Toys Division, and it was specifically, yeah, as you said, as like
shelf candy.
Shelf candy, or just like something little and fun that you can mess around with.
I can try to eat it.
Yeah, maybe you could probably eat it. I should probably put mine out of reach of my son.
Yeah.
Now that you mention it.
So the black one contains Sonic the Hedgehog, Outrun, Puyo Puyo 2, and something called Royal Stone. I don't even know what that is. But it's like, you know, a couple of heavy hitters there on the sort of default system.
Yeah.
The blue one has Sonic Chaos, Gunstar Heroes, another heavy hitter. Uh-huh. I can't imagine playing that on that.
No, that'd be terrible.
As fun as GG.
Sylvan Tail, and then a puzzle game called Baku Baku Animal. The red one, weirdly, it has Columns and Shinobi, you know, heavy hitters, popular internationally, and also Shin Megami Tensei, Last Bible Special, and Revelations, the Demon Slayer. So
really?
Two Atlas RPGs.
Hmm. And it's red.
And it's red, like Satan. And then the yellow one, the yellow one has three Shining Force games. The sort of Hadja, Shining Force Gaiden Ensei, and Shining Force Gaiden Final Conflict, plus Nazo Puyo Aruru no Ru, which I think is that like a Puyo Puyo RPG?
That sounds right, yeah.
So this is one that just, it's not like, you can import it, but you're not going to get a lot of mileage out of it if you don't read Japanese.
Yeah.
And a lot of Japanese.
But what a great library if you can read Japanese.
Right.
I am intrigued by the idea of a Puyo Puyo RPG, I have to admit. I would play that.
There was a time in the 90s when every franchise got an RPG. There was a Twinbee RPG.
Oh.
There was a Samurai Showdown RPG.
That's true.
There was going to be a Virtua Fighter RPG until it became Shenmue.
That's right.
It's just all over the place.
King of Fighters Kyo.
And then the white one came only with the Aleste collection for Switch, I believe.
Switch and PS4.
Oh, a PS4 also. And that one contains five games. M2 put their hearts into this one with Aleste. GG Aleste. Okay, so Aleste is
Power Strike in the US.
Power Strike for Master System.
Yes.
It's a Master System game running on Game Gear, which, you know, they mm-hmm. were the same thing. So
it's, yeah. That one is really hard to play on this thing, let me tell you.
I would imagine, because it's like taking the television resolution and crushing it down to Game Gear and then crushing it down to that tiny size. Yeah, so that's rough.
Yeah, that is.
But then there's GG Aleste, GG Aleste 2, then Power Strike 2, also for Master System, and GG Aleste 3, a brand new game created by M2. Is this game available in any other format?
It's available in the Aleste collection.
In the collection, okay. And so you can play it on a real system.
But it runs on original Game Gear hardware. I don't think anyone's been able to extract the ROM successfully from the collection, so.
Really? That's surprising.
Yeah, they put some sort of like security coding in there that has made it not run properly. But yeah, it's a super good game. It was one of my favorite games of 2020.
Yeah, and it came with, like, the collection came with like a fake gold box Mark III logo, you know, like a design for it that, you know, like if this had been released back in the day, they put some love into it for sure. But, you know, it's hard to play these. It's hard to enjoy them, but I do enjoy looking at them. They're cute. they're nice to have on your shelf.
Yeah, I can see why.
But that is so far, unless I'm overlooking something, the last of the mini consoles. Nintendo has not followed up with a mini Game Boy, and after seeing how the Game Gear Micro went, maybe they won't. They haven't put out an N64. Sony definitely hasn't put out a PlayStation 2 Micro.
You could argue that their Game & Watch Mario and Zelda things are sort of like that.
Kinda, sorta.
I mean, the one does have like Link's Awakening, but it's...
I feel like you could make a better argument for that if they actually included simulations of the original Game & Watch games that they are supposedly emulating, but they're not.
Yeah, I was always mad they didn't do that.
They haven't.
Yeah, because I mean, I loved Mario. I had the original Mario Game & Watch, and I would have loved to play it again.
Yeah, I mean, they would have had to make Zelda two-screen, but... You know, it's worth it.
That's the price of fame.
Get Spirit Tracks and Phantom Hourglass on there.
I will stand here and defend Spirit Tracks till I die.
They're both good. People are wrong. However, that's not the end of the line for mini systems, and I think at this point we hand the mic over to Brian to talk us through the Astro City Mini and the Egret 2 Mini, both of which are really quite good.
There's also the Neo Geo Mini.
The Neo Geo Mini. Okay, let's talk about that.
The Neo Geo Mini I actually do not have, so I can't quite talk about that.
The Neo Geo Mini doesn't have a lot of appeal for me because all of those games, I like Neo Geo fine, but all of those games, like all of them, are available, they're accessible in so many other ways.
They are.
Like you can just get them as arcade archives.
Yeah.
So why not do that and play them, you know, on systems that are more comfortable to hold as opposed to like a little... miniature arcade machine. Okay, so I do like the fact that with the Neo Geo Minis, SNK really sort of kicked off the idea of standalone,
Absolutely.
Dedicated, self-contained hard.
That's its biggest success, yeah. I think, yeah. as a system.
It set a standard, and you know that concept did exist already with Numbskulls Quarter Arcades,
yep.
and New Wave Toys,
yep.
Replicades, which we've talked about here on the show, but. This was a different approach. It wasn't like, hey, here is a bespoke simulation of a single arcade machine. It was, hey, here is a bespoke simulation of a Neo Geo, which, you know, had a lot of games on it. You could plug them and swap them and switch out the games. That was the whole point. It was affordable and inexpensive for arcade owners. So here, have, you know, 25 or 30 games.
Yeah, and I think the weird thing they did with this was that the game lineup was different depending on the version.
Mm-hmm. Mm. There's like the international version. There was a Christmas version.
Samurai Showdown version.
So yeah, they changed up the game lineups, but not all the game lineup, just
right.
parts of it. So it's kind of this weird chase piece if you're really into that. But yeah, I feel like another thing that I will say that the Neo Geo Mini introduced to this format is the standalone arcade machine with a video out.
Mm-hmm.
Like
right.
the New Wave Toys games did not have that until after Neo Geo Mini.
Right.
And once that came out, then you started to see video out in like Dragon's Lair and 1942 and so forth. And that, you know, that makes a difference for playability. Instead of having to look at the tiny little screen, you can, you know, use it as the basis of being able to play these games full scale, plug in USB controllers. It's much more enjoyable that way.
Absolutely.
Because let me tell you, playing two-player on the Street Fighter 2 cabinet, it's cool that they did that, and I love the little miniature second controller that they released for the Replicade,
yeah.
but it's not a great experience. Whereas, you know, plugging in a proper controller and playing on a TV, like, it gives you some versatility.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So let's hear it for what few things worthwhile the Neo Geo did. But then we get on to Sega with the Astro City Mini, which is a much more impressive endeavor, if not flawless.
Right. Yeah, it definitely has its flaws, but I mean, I guess maybe if someone was a real Neo Geo Mini fan, it's possible they may look at the Astro City Mini and not see what I do in it. But... It's pretty amazing, honestly. It like the Neo Geo Mini, it has HDMI output. It has a couple USB outputs in there for controllers, which Sega kind of didn't go all in on as Taito did, but they did. They had an Astro City colored just gamepad, mm-hmm. And they also had like a full size arcade stick. Mm-hmm. Which people bought even not to use on the Astro City Mini just because it looks really cool.
They also, they kind of followed suit from the Sega Genesis Mini with the style kit. And instead of, you know, being able to put a CD-ROM underneath it, Instead, it basically lets you take the top half of the cabinet, yes, which is how it's designed, and make it a full proportionate arcade machine.
Absolutely.
With a little marquee that has customization with stickers, yep, and even a little tiny stool,
oh,
for you to put like an action figure on.
Baby. I
have
it.
A picture on Twitter when I first got this of me taking an Ava Unit 1 figure and setting it up at
this.
Is
that you? Okay.
That was me. Yes.
I think I saw that.
Yeah, but it's a really nice touch. And I feel like what the Astro City Mini really realized that was started by, earlier we were talking about Star Fox 2, you know, an on-release game that made it onto the SNES Mini. Like, you had that in a little bit greater numbers here, like arcade titles that have previously never been ported to anything. And both the Egret and this do that fairly well, but I feel like it has a little bit more value here and is just a little bit more upfront.
Yeah, there are some kind of weird omissions until you actually figure out what the logic was, but you don't see Super Scalar games on here.
Right.
And that's because those were not originally issued as Astro City devices.
Mm.
So the Sega Astro City was, you know, kind of like the Neo Geo. It was a shell, basically.
Yeah.
You could plug alternate arcade boards into it. And so they tried to stick really closely to the spirit of that by, yep, only putting games that appeared in Astro City cabinets,
yep, right,
on this device. And that includes an extremely limited, simplistic game called Dotori-kun. Do you want to explain what that one's about?
Yeah.
Because it's a really cool little thing.
It is. It's looking at it, it's shocking how primitive it looks like, but it is a maze chase game, essentially. I mean, there's not a lot to talk about in terms of the gameplay. Yeah, it pretty much is head-on, but the reason it was in there is because when Sega sold Astro City cabinets in Japan, I can't remember if it was specifically a law or if this was just them doing a goodwill thing. Yeah, I think it was a law.
It was a law or maybe like a JAMA thing.
Yeah, they had to put a board in with the cabinet. So they just threw together this simple little thing, which ended up being Dotori-kun. And so there's so many boards of it because every Astro City cabinet had one. And of course, Mikado, which we mentioned earlier, has had tournaments for it because they have tournaments for literally everything.
What kind of game is it? I've never heard of it.
It's basically, it's kind of like a maze chase, but it's not really a maze because,
yeah,
it's open all around. There's like openings.
Uh-huh.
But it pretty much plays like head-on, right? Where you,
yep,
like can change lanes and move to the inside track.
Oh.
Yep.
And you're just trying to get all the dots on there,
yeah,
yep, while another car is trying to hit you.
Oh, okay, yep, yeah. That's cute.
Yeah.
I like,
but I mean,
it's got
some fairly vintage games on there, like Flicky is on there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But then it has some of the later era games like Arabian Fight, and it's got stuff like Cotton, which I didn't even realize Sega had published in arcades or distributed, but yeah, apparently so.
And there were certainly like Cotton ports to other systems there, but this is like weirdly the only way you can play like arcade perfect Cotton on a Sega arcade mini system.
Yes.
Also had the best Golden Axe game,
Death Adder.
Golden Axe Revenge of Death Adder,
yes,
which was never ported to anything.
No.
Before this.
Yeah, what is that one? Is that one like a fighting game, or is it?
No. It's a side-scrolling,
okay,
Golden Axe.
Is it the sequel?
Beat 'em up. It's
sequel.
Just extremely nice-looking compared to, you know, the Golden Axe
games. Is that the one that has, like, the kind of the cut scenes if someone's burned by Dragonfire? Like, I can't remember if that was the one. Like, it kind of...
I don't know that it has... We just played it the other night. I don't know that it has too many... it has, like, brief little cut scenes.
The cinemas. Yeah, that's what,
yeah,
I mean.
I don't remember. There might have been one with Dragonfire, but...
I just remember guys burning. I don't remember.
Yeah, oh, there's definitely a lot of things and people being set on fire, for sure. It has branching paths in it. It also has, gosh, I can't remember the character's name, but one of the selectable characters is a large man, and Gilius Thunderhead, the dwarf from previous Golden Axe games, is riding him and like... Ratatouille, like controlling him.
It's got to be a beyond, like a Mad Max thing, right? Like, I assume it's the two gladiator guys.
It might be, but I think it's way funnier to think of Gilius Thunderhead controlling.
I love that. I see Golden Axe is a game about mounts, and just the idea, here you have chicken leg, here you have a dragon, here you have a big right. Curly man.
And there is a centaur, character who has legs when they jump on like one of the mounts.
Yeah,
weirdly.
That freaks me out. What's going on there? Like, she literally loses her legs. She gets human legs. It's so strange.
Yes.
Great game, though.
It also had stack columns for anyone who really cares all that much about columns, which was a previously unported game outside of Japan, which I'm not a big columns player, but it had like a heavier emphasis on competitive play. There was a stack mechanic that they took from Columns 3 where you have this like gauge of poker chips that's building up as you build more combos. And then the higher you let that gauge build up, the more devastating, like, the attack you'll unleash on your other opponent will be, which is just a bunch of junk coming from below. And though this was ported, it interestingly had Columns 2, which I had no idea before I translated an interview from the proprietor of Mikado, that its one-player mode, Flash Columns, is so ridiculously difficult that no one is known to have beaten it. And there's a regular Columns 2 scene at Mikado. So all you Columns 2 sickos out there, you got a place to go
for it
now.
There are dozens of it. Dozens.
So the Astro City Mini also takes us into the future because there is another model coming out in a few months.
July.
Neither the Astro City Mini nor the Egret 2 Mini had like proper retail releases in the U.S., but both were distributed by specialty publishers. The Astro City Mini by Limited Run Games. The Egret 2 by Strictly Limited?
Special Reserve? So. Something like that.
I feel terrible. I can't keep track of all the companies similar to Limited Run out there. And they do a lot of Taito stuff, and I've bought a lot of Taito stuff from them, so it's not me throwing shade at them. I just can't remember their name. But the V is interesting because it's the V as in vertical. It has a Tate mode screen that's sideways because you could arrange the system like that in the arcades. But the games lineup, I think, only has one first party Sega game on it, which is Zaxxon. And everything else is, it's like third party shooters by, you know.
It's very shooter heavy.
Yeah, it's almost entirely shooters.
Yeah, and part of the reason for that actually is, again, the guy who runs Mikado is taking, like, they helped promote the original Astro City Mini a bit. They did some streams with Sega, but they're really helping on this.
Mm.
And so shooting games are, that's a huge, you know, mecca, a place for people to come to play shooting games. And so I think that's why, and I mean, of course, it's a genre that has a lot of vertical-oriented games.
It kind of kills me that they're putting Zaxxon on here, and it's a vertical screen, but they're not putting Congo Bongo on there, which ran on the
true.
Same hardware.
Yeah, like, that's true.
Come on, just break from the shooters a little bit and give us that bit of history.
There's like a wrestling game on there or something weirdly that one of the people involved really wanted to put on there, so I don't know.
But no Congo Bongo.
No Congo Bongo.
Anyway, so I'm looking forward to that. I've got that one pre-ordered and a style kit for it because that's me. That's the guy. I'm the guy who has like an office wall that is.
Gotta have the kits for
all
both of them.
The quarter arcades and replicades always running.
That's
people
sweet.
Come in and are like, oh, I just want to sit here and look at these.
Yep.
And I sit across from them and I do. I just like stare at them. And that's why I don't get any work done. So finally, we come to the most recent of the releases, which we've touched on a few times, several times throughout, the Taito Egret 2 Mini, which again, not quite perfect, but very cool. And
very cool.
I can't say it enough. I've talked about this already on the show, not even this episode, but other episodes. The dial controller feels so good. I can't believe the quality of just the build quality on this thing. Like, it's very, very expensive to get the whole kit.
It is.
It's like $600. But damn, it just feels great. The controller, the screen action is amazing too. Sega's like, buy the Astro City Mini. Now buy the Astro City Mini in vertical. And Taito's like, no. You're going to get it all at once. You only have to buy once, and we will let you change the screen orientation on your own. God bless them.
It's very satisfying to do it, too, for as weird as that sounds. Like, the clicking that it makes
it's got good... It's like the spinner. It's just very tactile.
Yeah.
It feels nice.
And even, like, even apart from the spinner, like, if you got the crazy kit, like, the pad is not great. Like, the D-pad on it is real mushy compared to the Astro City one. But the stick, like the actual arcade stick that came in it, is very good and very compact. Like, it's not a full-size, fight stick type deal like the Astro City Mini was. It's quite small. It has a good weight to it. And like the stick on the actual Mini itself, it has what to me is like one of the most amazing things, which is a dial you can just turn to change the gate in the stick from 8-way to 4-way to play like
That's
Gray
cool.
Maze or like games like that
yeah.
where, you know, a Pac-Man style game where you really don't want those diagonals to be in there at all.
The lineup on this is amazing.
Oh,
and the
is.
Fact is, like, you can actually in theory add more to it because
yep.
it has an SD card slot.
Yep.
And the spinner controller comes with an SD card that includes all the games. And if you plug it in, it kind
it
of
boots.
Takes over the system.
Yeah.
Mm.
So then you have to take it out if you want to access the other games.
Yep.
But yeah, the lineup covers an amazing span of Taito history from Space Invaders up through Elevator Action Returns, which was, you know, almost 20 years later.
Yeah.
And it's just... It's remarkable. It's the system knows how the screen is oriented, so you don't have to like say, well, if you want to play Space Invaders and you don't feel like popping the screen to be vertical, it'll just scale it down so that it fits in the horizontal screen. It's not making the most of the space, but still, like it's no fuss. No, it's very intelligent. I wish some of the emulation were a little better. I hope that they release updates for it. Like, in theory, they could.
Yeah, yeah.
Have they said anything about that?
Not that I've heard. I haven't gone through all of the games on there in detail, but yeah, Darius Gaiden is a game I've practiced quite a bit, and I can immediately tell by playing the version on there that's a little choppy and music cuts out and that sort of thing, but certainly not unplayable. The one thing they have talked about, which is not really updates to the existing games, but they did Japanese polls asking what people wish had been on there. And Night Striker was an overwhelming one, which is a flight stick game. And they didn't promise anything, but they did say, yeah, in theory, we could release it on an SD card with another controller, and if it was worthwhile, it's something we would in theory consider doing.
They need to give us Darius and Darius 2 and the Ninja Warriors and let us link together three systems.
Please do it.
The three of those systems lined up for the full span of the screens.
Darius Collection and Night Striker, Taito. Come on.
that's what we're talking about. But I mean, just in terms of like the Bubble Bobble family alone, you've got Bubble Bobble, Bubble Memories, Bubble Symphony, Chack and Pop, Don Doku Don, Fairyland Story. What else is in there?
Puzzle Bobble 2X, which is like a weird version of Puzzle Bobble 2 that
New
never
Zealand
made
Story.
It in Japan.
So that's like almost 10 games that are just tied to Bubble Bobble.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a lot of bobble.
I love it. It's so much bobbling. So much bubbling.
Yeah. Bubbling and bobbling all the way home.
Any? So yeah, the emulation is kind of the weak point, and it's not bad.
No,
it's just a little off.
It's a little off. And interestingly, people smarter than me did these analyses. But if you're comparing like just playing it on the actual unit itself between the Astro City Mini and the Egret, I guess the Astro City Mini has a significantly lower latency screen than the Egret does.
Huh.
So you get like less frames of lag playing pretty much anything on the Astro City than you do on the Egret. Just
maybe that's just the downside of having an adaptable screen.
I suspect it might be, yeah.
Well, that's a darn shame. But still, despite those shortcomings, I really love the Egret 2 Mini.
It's great.
And it's still, I believe it's still available through Special Reserve. Strictly Limited. Strictly Limited. That's the one it is.
I think so.
Yes. So Strictly Limited Games has the... see? I'm being equitable. I'm promoting a competitor because they did a good deed and they brought over the Egret 2
Very
Mini.
Very noble.
For the West. But yeah, it's just a really cool collectible. And again, it's one of those that you can plug in controllers, you can hook it up to a TV, and you can play Elevator Action too, which is really the only thing that ultimately matters when it comes to playing video games.
That's true.
You need to crush the old order and create a new society.
Literal crush.
Treat that nuke.
That's right. Got to stop it. I mean, one of my best memories of going to any games convention was a few years ago at Long Island Retro Expo, and they have a ton of free play systems set up, and I sat down and started playing Elevator Action Returns, Elevator Action 2, whatever you want to call it, and got like 2/3 of the way through the game, and this other guy just kind of sat down and started to play as player 2, and we didn't say a word. he just played and helped out, and we stopped the nuke from launching, which is really hard to do when you play solo. And we were both like, good game. And he took off. And yeah, that was great. It was just like...
Better love story silent, than Twilight.
Silent camaraderie. I really appreciated it.
Platonic ideal.
Yep. Eddie Burritt can't do it on her own. She needs the help of Jad the Taff. That has been the madness that is mini consoles. Like I said, Stuart, I think, will be doing something about mini computers at some point and going into excessive detail about the Amiga Mini, I'm sure. But there's a whole thriving market out there of tiny devices, and I would love to see more of these happen. I mean, Numbskull and New Wave Toys are that's kind of their business, so they're going to keep doing it. But I'd love to see more from Nintendo.
Yeah.
I'd love to see Sony do a mulligan, give us a PS1 mini, like the little, the little second model PS PlayStation that has better emulation, a better selection of games. I don't know. What else?
They could even call it the better, like, sorry we screwed up, PlayStation version.
I would love for Nintendo to give us a PlayChoice 10 mini.
That'd be great.
That's what I want.
Yeah.
I want like the full suite of every game that was released for PlayChoice 10. And you've got to have two little screens on there, and you actually have to like press the little button underneath the coin release to put in another quarter for another 300 seconds of playtime.
I think you're onto
something.
That'd
be great. Yes, they won't ever do it because it's too cool. Nintendo, like, oh, someone else came up with a cool idea. Well, we can't do that.
Can't do it. No.
I would love to see something that I know will absolutely never happen. Something like a Bandai Playdia mini, which is really just a bunch of anime license games. But they are, at least to me, they're interesting curiosities, and I don't really want to buy a Playdia and software for it as well. So it would be cool to have something with just like everything that ever came out on it, because I'm pretty sure they have the licenses to all of that. So it wouldn't even be like working with places to get games on there. Like, it's just throw everything that's on there and on and go.
I feel like Sega might give us a Dreamcast Mini or a Saturn Mini.
I think that's
going to
happen. I think it's going to be Dreamcast.
I guess we'll just do the whole thing. Give us an SG-1000 Mini or a Mark III Mini that has Master System and SG-1000 games on it. Whatever.
I think they'll continue to do those, and I think they'll probably continue to do more arcade ones because those are like separate divisions handling both of those. So I think they will just continue to take those out. Our 360 Mini for the next mini arcade after the Astro City.
Oh, now that you say that, an Xbox 360 mini. Maybe that's too soon, but an Xbox mini, I could see. I could see. What's their name? Microsoft. Yes, I could see them doing
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
that little plucky little company no one's ever heard of.
Coming.
Yeah, I feel like there have been some Japanese home computers, like, you know, like a
yeah,
like 68,000 mini or something like that.
I didn't realize
is
how
that
like
real?
Specialized
or X1 mini maybe.
The whole mini console business had become, like, to me, I'm thinking in terms of, oh, the PlayStation kind of took the wind out of everyone's sails, and maybe that's the case for, like, the mainstream version of these mini consoles, but, you know, hearing you go on about the little ones, it's still obviously extremely popular.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, I think there is a sort of a built-in audience out there, and I would love for these companies to continue catering to us. I don't have any more room for these things, but I will still buy them.
You'll find a place.
And I hope I can find a place. I guess I got to clear out some stuff for my recording setup. Do I really need all these systems and a Mister when I could just capture everything from Mister? Probably not. I probably need to be pragmatic about it at some point. They are. They're so good. RGB modded consoles. I love them. But
there's also the option of just buying another house.
There you go. There's your solution right there.
Let me tell you about a little thing called the housing market.
Yeah. No, I know. I had to experience that recently.
Especially where I live. It's bad.
Is it really? That's too bad.
It's a thriving market. But that's okay because the mini console market also thrives in our hearts and in our wallets, which are not thriving. Anyway, that's it for this episode of Retronauts. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I have been Jeremy Parrish, and these have been other people, and we are talking about old video games, which we do every week at Retronauts.com, on the HyperX Podcast Network, on mini podcatchers of various and sundry forms, and, of course, at Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts, which is how this show is supported. If you subscribe to us, you can hear every episode that we do, every single episode, a week early at a higher bitrate quality with no advertisements or promotions, which is cool. If you subscribe for $5 a month, you also get bonus episodes on alternating Fridays, plus a column every weekend from Diamond Fight with a little mini podcast attached, Discord access, and various and sundry other cool things. So go to patreon.com/retronauts, check us out, subscribe to us, make the show happen. Allow me to keep feeding my horrible mini console addiction. I thank you. My wife does not. Anyway, let's see. Kevin, you don't have a microphone. So, Nadia. Actually, Brian, why don't you tell us where we can find you on the internet? And then you can hand the mic to Brian.
I think I'm the only person here who isn't involved with the Patreon. So my pet project for a while has been 1millionpower.com. My elevator pitch for it is it's like Shmupulations, but weirder. I tend to pick goofier topics to translate interviews for, but it's a lot of developer interviews, things like that. Lots of Japanese rock related stuff there too. So if any of that sounds interesting to you, please come on by.
All right. Nadia.
I am also part of Retronauts, and when I'm not doing Retronaut stuff, I am on the Axe of the Blood God RPG podcast. We cover RPGs old, new, east, and western. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/bloodgodpod. And I am on Twitter at Nadia Oxford.
And I'm Kevin Bunch. You can find me on Twitter at Ubersaurus. I've also got the YouTube channel Atari Archive and the associated Patreon, also Atari Archive. And you can check me out if you want to see me discuss video game history one Atari game at a time in chronological order.
And finally, Jeremy Parrish, that's me. You can find me on the internet. I'm all over the place for the moment. I'm still on Twitter. We'll see how long that lasts as GameSpite. And I'm on YouTube. And of course, as I've mentioned here, I'm at limitedrungames.com publishing books. And you can go buy those books. Some of them are mine. Some of them are by the people here in this room. Oh my God.
Oh, gracious.
Dun, dun, dun.
Nadia hasn't committed anything yet, but Kevin and Brian are both publishing books through Limited Run, and they're going to be great. So please check them out. Check it out. And of course, check out more Retronauts coming at you soon. Stay tuned. And now go play some Elevator Action 2, because that's all that really matters.